Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We talk about ADHD this hour of the program. New data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show this remarkable statistics. Nearly one in five high school age boys in this country and 11% of school age children overall have received a medical diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And this is a marked rise over the last decade. It got us thinking, why is this diagnosed so often? And could it be that ADHD diagnosis and medication are overused in American children? One more set of statistics. 6.4 million children ages 4 to 17 received an ADHD diagnosis at some point in their lives. It's a 16% increase since 2007 and a 41% rise in the past 10 years. Whew! That requires some examination, we thought. Our guest is Professor William Groff. He is a professor of pediatrics and neurology at Yale School of Medicine. He grew up in Madison, studied biochemistry at the University of Wisconsin, went to Germany to do further studies, and then studied even further in the United States. He's worked at Seattle Children's Hospital, Group Health in Seattle, Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, and focuses on diagnostic approaches to complex neurodevelopmental disorders and medical care for families whose children have neurodevelopmental disabilities. We've already had a lot of comments on our Facebook page on this. I would imagine we're going to have many phone calls for Professor Groff. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where messages are there already, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Groff, hello. Thank you very much for being with us. Oh, you're on a different line here. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. Hi, Professor Groff. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thanks so much. I look at these numbers, and they just are amazing to me. This is a huge increase just since 2007 and a 41% rise in the past 10 years. What's going on?
Yeah, that's the good question. What is going on? It's a huge rise. There are lots of different explanations for this, depending on how you define it, how you assess it, the motivation of people to have a diagnosis like this. It's a pretty complicated topic, and it involves our society, our economy, our politics, and our culture.
You made it even bigger. Then it becomes a huge topic. Can you, first of all, just explain what ADHD is and if it is easily diagnosed? Do you know when you see it?
Well, it's pretty common in every classroom. If it's 5% of the population, it's going to be one kid in every kindergarten class that has it. So everybody has seen this, probably either a child in their neighborhood or somebody they know. But it has variable definitions. I think most people think that it is a neurological disorder, which is defined by behavioral characteristics, which are inattention, impulsivity, and hyperactivity. And there are different words for those things, and there's different expansions of those traits, as opposed to a sense that this is a behavioral disorder, which is characterized by signs of developmentally inappropriate attention, impulsivity, and hyperactivity. There has been a long debate for a long time about whether this was biologically based or a consequence of bad behavior. I think most people today feel it's definitely biologically based.
Mm-hmm. And if you were go to a doctor to find out if your child has this, are there certain tests that are quite accurate and can be done so you know beyond a shadow of a doubt?
It's a very subjective diagnosis, and there are lots of criteria that people have established, and not everybody follows every criteria. So that's part of the problem, and it might be part of the explanation for the rise. But and it was an interesting segue to DSM-5 and the news hour, because that's coming out this month. But up until now, we've had the criteria of DSM-4, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And they have a list of 18 core symptoms of ADHD, which are divided into two major domains. One is inattention, and the other is impulsivity and hyperactivity. And then it's sort of a Chinese menu. You have to sort of go through the list and say that you have a significant amount of these to a degree of certainty. And then it has to be validated by multiple sources. So you have to get school teachers agreeing with parents. And if it is only observable in one setting, then the diagnosis is less likely to be made.
Mm. And if you are medicated for this, what do you take for it, and what are the results of this? What kind of human being does it make you?
Well, stimulants are common. They're common in different forms, but we're talking mostly about prescription drugs here, and we're talking about prescription amphetamines or something equivalent to an amphetamine. The two major drugs that are used are methylphenidate, which is Ritalin, and Concerta, which is the long-acting form. And then various forms of amphetamines, which are Adderall and other drugs with common names that people have heard of. These drugs are stimulants, so they're sort of like coffee. And about 70% of the population drinks coffee on a regular basis, or caffeine, mm-hmm. which is sold over-the-counter in supermarkets. But it's a little bit more powerful than that. It has a much more powerful mechanism of action. These drugs work on the dopaminergic systems of the brain. They sort of inhibit the reuptake of dopamine in the synapses. So there's a little bit extra dopamine available, and that causes the brain to focus and concentrate a little bit better. Some of that is subjective, just like you may have a notable response to coffee and notice that it's different than decaf, but there's a certain subjectivity, especially for students who take these drugs as study drugs.
Mm-hmm. And do we have statistics on how long a period of time children are on this drug? Is it something you do for your lifetime, or does it ADHD disappear at some point?
I think those are a couple of questions mixed together.
Yes, they are.
But so it was back in 1937 that it was noted that amphetamines actually improve focus and concentration. It was given by Bradley in 1937 for children with headaches, and mm-hmm. he actually noted serendipitously that the children's behavior and school performance got better. That there was a long history of the use of these drugs then thereafter. It's interesting historically that in the Second World War, a lot of stimulants were taken. The German military actually supplied 35 million tablets of methamphetamine
really?
To its soldiers.
Really?
Yeah, a drug called Pervitine was the name of the drug.
Huh.
And it was given to fighter pilots as well. In the 1940s, Strauss syndrome was named. It was thought for a long time to be the result of some sort of a brain injury. So there was different words that were used in the 50s, cerebral dysfunction. Even for a while, they talked about brain injury syndromes. But after a certain point, it became clear that this was not an injury by any means. The DSM-1 didn't even mention ADHD. DSM-2 called it the hyperkinetic reaction to childhood. And along these times, articles started to come out about the use of methylphenidate and the benefits of Ritalin in children back in the 1960s. Mm. But to answer your question, back then, generally speaking, children only took it for shorter periods of time, and it was much more common to have medication holidays where kids would stop taking the medication on weekends and summer vacation. Over the course of time, it's been used more and more and more, and we've got data to show that.
Mm-hmm.
The DSM-3 came out in the 80s. It was called ADD for a while, with or without hyperactivity. DSM-3R merged the two and called it ADHD for the first time. And for the last almost 20 years, we've had the DSM-4. And the main symptoms, again, are inattention, hyperactivity, impulsivity, and they break it down beyond that to different subgroups where you can have inattention alone or hyperactivity, impulsivity alone. The response to the medication is not part of the definition, and that's frequently misunderstood. So people will say, here, try some Ritalin or try some Adderall, and they might have some sort of a subjective response to it, but that isn't the definition of ADHD. And so what do the medications do for you? Some people tolerate them, some don't. Again, in some sort of a comparison to caffeine, if 70% of the population generally likes to drink caffeine, and these are Starbucks-type data, then about 80% of children who have the typical ADHD traits will respond to a stimulant positively. And then there's a question sometimes about dose, and there's a question about what type of stimulant, because they're slightly different, and there's a number of them on the market.
You were quoted in the New York Times recently as saying mild symptoms are being diagnosed so readily, which goes well beyond the disorder and beyond the zone of ambiguity to peer enhancement of children who are otherwise healthy.
So one of the ways of thinking about ADHD over the last 20 years is there's been a big debate about whether this is a categorical diagnosis where you would say it's sort of black and white, either you have ADHD or you don't have ADHD, as opposed to more current thinking where they use the term dimensional, which means along a spectrum. So you have a lot of children who will have milder symptoms, and there might be some pressure to diagnose those children. The whole spectrum, though, is confounded by the notion of neuroenhancement on one side, where you have completely healthy children who want to take prescription amphetamines to do well in school. So this is where they don't have any disorder at all. And then you have this, the zone of ambiguity is this middle group, which has some traits. And again, since they're so subjective, people might start labeling the diagnosis faster. In terms of the rise in numbers of diagnoses, we don't really have much data about the neuroenhancement crowd. It's not really legal to sell these drugs. We call this diversion, where you take somebody else's prescription and give it to a student. And that's actually a felony. It's selling a Schedule II drug, so it's the equivalent of selling cocaine. And it's not controlled very tightly. I don't hear anybody getting arrested for selling methylphenidate or Adderall in the library. But it technically is not legal, so nobody's really talking about it. And there aren't any really good studies except for surveys. But again, you have this full continuum of real ADHD, which seems to be a real neurological disorder with real impairment, to some milder traits, to then a crowd that is taking it for a totally different reason. And they might be running up the numbers, too, since some of the drugs that are given to those students directly from the physicians might be coded as ADHD.
The same aforementioned article said that it could be that some studies have said it's about 30% of these pills are being either given to friends or sold to friends. That's a large number, isn't it? 30%?
That's survey data and estimates, but it's probably believable. If you go on college campuses and you talk to students, it's a pretty well-known fact that around exam times, everybody's taking Adderall. Not everybody, but a good percentage of students are. And you won't find literature on that very much. There's a couple articles written by students that say that, but they don't have good data, objective data. If you look at the United Nations data of what's happened over the last 20 years, the global manufacture of methylphenidate, which again is Ritalin, it increased tenfold from 4.2 tons in 1992 to 45 tons in 2011. And the calculated global consumption of this drug during that same time period is 139 million defined daily doses to 1.5 billion. A sum total of 51 tons of methylphenidate that was manufactured in 2011. So this is one measure of why we know that this is more common, because even last year, the year before, there was a national shortage of methylphenidate. So we know that the drugs are being manufactured, we know they're being consumed, and it's increasing not only in the United States but also worldwide.
You mentioned coffee earlier. Why don't we just drink coffee or caffeinated drinks when we need to pay attention to something? I mean, would that be better for us? I ask this in all seriousness.
Right, and then energy drinks is also a big new industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, which is mostly caffeine and different amounts in different quantities. Uh-huh. So a can of a Diet Cola has 55 milligrams of caffeine. A tall Starbucks has about 200. And you have everything else in between. Some of the energy drinks are up to 280 milligrams of caffeine. If people drink more than 300 milligrams of caffeine, they get a little bit jittery. And usually people self-regulate this. But, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. If you had ADHD traits, the two best things you could probably do would be to, in terms of safety, would be to use caffeine, I would think. And also this distractibility issue, this whole problem with the human brain, the cultural aspects of ADHD, meaning our culture has become very ADHD-ogenic. It's very oriented towards sound bites, 140-character tweets, very short interruptions throughout the day, short interruptions that a lot of debate about how these distractions can lead the human brain to be somewhat less focused. It's remarkable how much better a term paper can get written if you turn off your cell phone and turn off your Facebook and your text messaging and your email.
You need to do a public service announcement and distribute it widely to students all over, saying just that. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have tons of people on the line. Let me just give you our number and give you alternate ways to reach us if you're in a hurry. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, and we have several messages there, which we will get to, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about ADHD. I just think this is extraordinary, the huge rise in the number of cases of diagnosis of ADHD and then subsequent treatment, pill treatment of ADHD. What's going on, I guess, is the question of this hour. When is it legitimate? When is it overprescribed? How much of it is, somebody needs to do a study on how much of this is being sold on campuses and in schools. Our phone number, again, 800-486-8655. William Groff is our guest. He is a professor of pediatrics and neurology at the Yale School of Medicine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor William Groff, and let's start with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. I called last hour, but I can't help it if you guys have such interesting topics. I have two very quick anecdotes, and I'd love the professor's perspective on them in terms of ADHD, perhaps overdiagnosis, and also where some of this may be coming from. I took my boys to their pediatrician, who's known them since they were babies here in Madison, and he said to me several years ago, your boys don't play video games, do they? And I said, well, you know, we'll put quarters in machines, but we don't really have anything at home. And I said, why do you ask? And he said, I'm just kind of taking an informal poll. I've been doing it for a number of years, and I'm about 95% accurate in predicting just from a little bit of conversation with the kids where they fall on the continuum of just, you know, the stimulation of video games at home. And more recently, we bought a video machine, Xbox, and I couldn't wait to play the race car game. And, man, I went to bed that first night, and I just had, like, thoughts just jumping in and out of my head in a way that I wasn't used to. And it just felt like the quick, fast turns of that race car game was just playing out in my head all over again. And then the other quick anecdote, I supervise student teachers for the UW's elementary education program. And I had a student teacher who said, a first grade student teacher who said, boy, we've got this little African-American boy in the classroom, and he just can't sit still, and we're trying to get him on some medication, but his mom just won't advocate for him. We've tried so hard, but she just won't get behind us and help him out. And at our university, there was a requirement to do community involvement, and I said, you know, I'd like you to follow this little boy into another setting besides school. And she chose to go to his church. And he sat there in a pew. She reported to me after she sat there for a Sunday nearby him. And he paid attention with his little brother and little sister. He helped carry the offering plate when they went down to Sunday school. He was the leader in that line. And she said, I just don't understand why he'd only need ADHD medication 5 days a week. He seems to be okay in Sunday school. So I just like the professor's comments on those anecdotes.
Professor Groff.
So when we talk about the developing brain, we're talking about educational systems as well, because when you go to school, you're educating your brain, and it's developing, and you're learning. So these two topics constantly go back and forth: what's happening in school, what's happening in the child's life before and after school. The video game story is a very interesting one, but part of the ADHD concept is that you have attention, and you will hold your attention to certain things. And we talk about these reward systems within the brain, and also intrinsic rewards and extrinsic rewards. Intrinsic rewards are things that are significant and important to the child. So if you're very intent at playing a video game and you're typically a boy who wants to win, you'll hold your attention for long periods of time. Some people say that ADHD is maybe a reward deficiency syndrome, so you're not getting enough intrinsic interest in what you're doing, and that's an overlapping topic with school systems. Are we actually stimulating our kids enough, keeping their attention? The overlapping topic here is how many very famous creative people supposedly had ADHD, and there's actually a Wikipedia page of famous ADHD people, and the list goes on and on, from athletes, Pete Rose, Michael Phelps, actors like Robin Williams, Bill Cosby, movie directors, Alfred Hitchcock, artists, musicians, Mozart, Beethoven, Elvis Presley. The list goes on and on. Vince Lombardi, who's famous in Wisconsin, supposedly had ADHD. Albert Einstein is a scientist. Political pundits like Glenn Beck and James Carville. And actually some presidents have been thought to have ADHD traits historically. So that one of the questions that comes up for people that find themselves and find out what they're really interested in is whether or not ADHD is the norm. And that's part of the controversy. There are books written about the square peg. So you're a 5.5-year-old boy, and you have to sit in circle time for 20 minutes with your hands to yourself and not move. And some kids can do it and some can't. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're a bad person or that you don't have a creative brain. And I think that's why we try to be very, very tolerant. We're also looking for good outcomes. So we have to make sure kids are doing well, and we have to be accurate in our diagnoses. But there is a long discussion about, you know, with these ADHD traits, how much of them are actually part of the developing brain.
And what can you explain why boys are diagnosed much more often than girls?
Well, that's a big topic, Kathleen. Boys are different than girls. I think everybody can see that. So the story goes that, you know, 15,000 years ago, the boys were the hunters, and they needed to be vigilant, and they had to have a high degree of vigilance, and that meant that they had to keep on moving, and that was their hyperkinesis, so that it was a natural thing in the development of humankind. Obviously, we've evolved a lot from hunters and gatherers for our food to very structured academic school settings where kids have to sit still and oftentimes don't have enough recess time, which is becoming a bigger controversy these days.
Yes.
In terms of the need that kids have to go out and just move between academic assignments.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Madison. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. So my question was, is there any research being done on whether parents are going into doctors saying, I want my child to be tested, and could that push from the parents saying, my child's too hyper, I can't really control them, they don't listen, could that be a push leading to the rise in diagnosis that we're seeing?
Well, there's some conflicting data about that. The number of doctor visits for ADHD is increasing, and then I think the way we look at this is the difference between pediatric care and adult medicine is that you don't just have the doctor-patient relationship. You have in pediatrics the doctor-child-parent relationship. And that's one issue, is that it's sort of a triad initially. And as kids become adolescents, it's more geared towards developing autonomy of the adolescent. But the other model that's shifting is that, in the old days we had a very paternalistic healthcare system where the doctor knows best model. And now we've shifted dramatically to an individualized mode of practice. It's sort of a democratized model of practice. We call it family-centered care. And the doctors are under a lot of pressure, too, to sort of give families what they want. And there's not a lot written about this, but what we do know is that there are these patient satisfaction surveys. So it puts the physician these days in a little bit more awkward role of being a provider and giving a consumer what they want. And that's sort of a setup to say that if a family had the opinion that the child had these symptoms, the doctor might be more obliged to give in. I don't think there's enough known about that right now, though, but we do know that doctors are being rated by patients.
Thanks, Elizabeth, for the call. We've had a lot of Facebook messages as well. Let's go to a couple of these right now. Beth writes, I hope childhood trauma is included in the discussion. Post-traumatic stress disorder in kids looks a lot like ADHD, but pediatric health providers don't always screen for this when they are dispensing meds.
There's been a lot of analysis of the foster child situation because they can look at numbers in terms of how many medications foster children have as opposed to children with one or two parent households. Post-traumatic stress syndrome is not always present in foster families, but oftentimes it is. Mm. Oftentimes children are being taken away for a reason. And you can try to measure PTSD in various ways, but there's been a lot of criticism as well that foster children might get more medication. They certainly have very good access. And from my perspective and my practice, the foster parents of our society are the heroes of our society. They're volunteer parents who are usually excellent parents who volunteer to take in difficult kids. And we have a lot of discussions with the case manager, the social worker, the foster parent. And oftentimes they're dealing with really difficult situations and children who have, for lack of a better term, PTSD, but a lot of stress in their lives. I think there are checks and balances in place not to over-medicate children. But if you look at the numbers, I think it shows that foster children probably do get a little bit more medication.
Mm-hmm. We go to Sheree in Waupun. Hi, Sheree.
Hi. I have a daughter who's diagnosed ADHD. She's 14 now. And just to kind of answer what the woman had called earlier, personally, when I took her to the doctor, it was with a mound of paperwork from her teachers, from everybody that she knew. And she had a lot of symptoms where she wouldn't go to sleep and things like that. However, what was most surprising to me was the social interactions. My daughter has a hard time sometimes keeping friends. She had a hard time making friends for a while. She couldn't seem to keep them. Her doctor and I to this day still disagree on whether or not she has a dual diagnosis of Asperger's because of that. And I know that can sometimes happen. So can you maybe talk about the social interactions and the issues that maybe children with ADHD have because of the, because of the difficulty with concentration?
Yeah, that's a very important topic, and it's a very good question. Because this is such a dimensional topic, I think that it's been decided that you can have ADHD traits and other symptoms that are not essential to having ADHD, but if you look at the numbers, there's this huge overlap with other mild neurological conditions, and those include mostly learning disabilities, which is about half of all children with ADHD. Many have tics, maybe have clumsiness, in other words, mild motor problems. Speech and language disorders are very common. Sleep disorders are very common. Immaturity, disorganization, poor peer relationships, being oppositional, and being moody. That's very common. As a matter of fact, sometimes the moodiness is worse than the hyperactivity, and that's what drives it. There are also other medical diagnoses that kids have, and I think that's the most important role for the physician. ADHD is very common in children with epilepsy. Children with asthma have more ADHD, although that's not thought to have a cause and effect relationship or because of the drugs for asthma. So there are these comorbidities, these huge overlapping features, and they're not all going to be solved by a little Adderall, that's for sure. That's why the schools need to be involved. There are discussions that have to go on at the IEP meeting, the Individual Educational Program. Kids with ADHD get a little bit less than the full IEP a lot of the time. They'll be categorized as other health impaired, so we can talk about that a little bit, but if I can answer the question differently, there is a lot of overlap with other mild neurological impairments. Mm.
And thank you very much, Sheree, for your call. Our guest this hour is Dr. William Groff. He is a professor of pediatrics and neurology at Yale School of Medicine. We're talking about ADHD and why so many more diagnoses of ADHD. There will be even more, according to the New York Times article, and we'll ask the doctor about this. More teens are likely to be prescribed in the medication in the near future because of a changed definition of ADHD to allow more people to receive diagnosis and treatment. But it's a huge increase, 16% increase in diagnosis since 2007, 41% in the past decade. So there are large numbers of young people in this country who are taking medicine for the ADHD, and we're trying to figure out what's the reason for that. Our phone number, our lines have been busy, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, we'll be talking about the hunger strikes and the future of Guantanamo. Our guests will include a law professor who has in the past worked to assist Guantanamo prisoners access the U.S. justice system and has also testified before Congress on habeas corpus. Also joining the conversation will be Jason Brozek, who's a professor of government and international affairs at Lawrence University. So that's coming up tomorrow. Back to phone calls. Before we go to phone calls, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Groff, about this more prescribed medication in the near future. The American Psychiatric Association is changing the definition of ADHD. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, the changes are slight, I think, but more broad. So that opens the door a little bit to more diagnosis as well. There's been a big discussion about the ages. So the age of onset is being raised from 7 to 12. Part of the reason for that is people feel that if you have the inattentive type, you might get missed in early grade school and it might be more apparent later on in middle school or high school. There's also been a lot of concern about lower age limits. This is a very hard diagnosis to make in the preschool age group, and people have been very leery to ever make the diagnosis of ADHD prior to about age 6. But on one hand, the traits are there early on most of the time, but not always. The age and the DSM-5 will be raised to 12. And there's been a lot of interest in adult ADHD. It's been a big topic for the last 10 years or so. And again, people seem to adapt to their inabilities to focus and concentrate and keep on task. And adults will have different types of problems, less hyperactivity.
Mm-hmm. Patty is next in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for the topic. I'm just thinking back about 10 years ago, we had a son who was a young kindergartner, and he was. We were requested by his kindergarten teacher to have him diagnosed. You know, he couldn't stand still in line, and he fell out of his chair during snack time. So we went through all the procedures, and the bottom line was he had a high intellect score and was impulsive. And he was a 5.5-year-old boy, you know. So we took this information to our pediatrician, and she said, you know, she wouldn't medicate him. She would keep sending him. We had a request that maybe he be retained for a year in kindergarten. She suggested that we send him on to first grade. He's 16 going on 17. He's going to be a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
He does very good in school. I mean, he's not always an A student because he has to be in three sports. You know, he's very active. We know that about him. We embrace that about him. And like any other teenager, sometimes he drives you crazy, but we think it was because our pediatrician sat down with us and said, let's see what happens. Let's just, you know, he's only 5.5.
Right.
You know, and we're so glad we listened to her. The other person that helped us was Dr. Zorba Pastor that I heard say, you know, sometimes a cup of caffeinated tea in the morning can help.
Hmm.
So I started that when he was about first and second grade.
Really?
And, you know, I think we're very fortunate that we went with our heart at this one.
Dr. Groff.
Oh, Patty, thank you very much for the call because I couldn't agree more. I see this all the time. I saw it in my practice actually yesterday afternoon. A boy who I'd followed came back after a period of surveillance, and he's just matured wonderfully. And I asked his parents also, why? What did you do right? And they didn't really know either, but kids get better some of the time. This is in conflict to some of the data that you'll read about what a lifelong condition ADHD can be. And I think in deference to the people that have a more severe form of ADHD, it has to be respected. Not everyone is going to be like your son, Patty, or like the patient I saw yesterday. But I think that the part of the problem in the rising rates might be too quick to diagnose. Part of that might be because of the healthcare system, the way it's designed for quick fixes and quick action, quick visits.
Mm-hmm.
Something that everybody's concerned about. I don't think the doctors are happy about this either. I have the luxury of taking a longer period of time in my practice. I take an hour for the first patient and have usually 40 minutes for a follow-up visit. So I don't see as many kids. The kids in my practice are a little bit more disabled for the most part, and the issues are usually a little bit greater.
Mm-hmm.
But many pediatricians are having to see a lot of kids every day, and it's hard to really get a good grasp. I think that their advantage is that they get to follow the kids longitudinally for longer periods of time, which is the explanation for why Patty's pediatrician made the right decision, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Patty, very much for your call. Pam in Madison, hi. Pam?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, I can hardly hear you. My own research of the last 25 years, I've been developing a causal model of behavior and following the obesity epidemic since 1980, which makes me wonder, when did this start? When did the bump hit? We're focusing on the numbers of, 17 and 40%, because those are the most recent numbers of increase, but when did the rise really start?
My sense is that we're talking about it now because of a recent CDC study. But if you track the data, it's been rising steadily over the last 20 years. This is not a surprise to us at all. So, and the reasons are multifactorial. It might parallel the obesity epidemic that we're having. The relationship clearly between environmental toxins or allergies or specific diets, either lack of nutrients or too much food, that isn't as clear, again, because it's so multifactorial. Just think about it for a minute, because you're talking about studying a condition that's hard to define in and of itself. And then you've got lots of different factors. And the same problem has been with the genetics of ADHD, which probably haven't changed in 20 years. I mean, I would imagine that humans have been fairly steady. The technology's changed. Our ability to look at things like this has changed, like the genetics. But in the environmental factors, there's not a lot of solid data to show correlations between any poison or risk factor that might be leading to higher rates of ADHD.
Should there be such studies?
Well, there's lots of studies. They're very hard to read, some of them, because they're relatively small. Mm. Each patient group that they're studying is not always the same. It's a heterogeneous population. And their common denominator is that they have these traits. But it's a very complicated topic. The human brain is very complicated.
It is, isn't it? And just think about all you know about it, and we don't. Thanks very much, Pam, for the call. A Facebook message from Deb, or it's not from Deb, it's from Megan, who wonders, are minority males disproportionately diagnosed with ADHD?
There's mixed data. I was looking at a study that came from University of Wisconsin that looked at discrepancies in geographical regions throughout the state. The CDC data looked at all 50 states and did at least, I think, 1,800 or 2,000 phone calls per state and found huge geographic variation. It's a lot more common, more prevalent in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the Western states have much less ADHD. The United States was the leader in stimulant consumption. Actually, Canada and Iceland have surpassed the United States now in terms of methylphenidate consumption.
Hmm.
Socioeconomic groups have been looked at closely, and different people have come to different conclusions about why people with insurance or no insurance would be diagnosed more or less. But in general, there are disparities geographically, between countries, between states, between socioeconomic groups, and the data isn't crystal clear.
Let's go next to Judy in Madison. Hi, Judy.
Well, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just calling. My story is real similar to Patty, who had called earlier. My grandson in kindergarten and first grade had gone through all of the diagnostic testing and was really pressured by the pediatrician as well to be put my grandson on the medication. And parents had made a decision to not. He had been through a lot. He's living with his father as a single father. The mother isn't in the picture. So there was a lot of things going on. And now we're in fifth grade, and he's found the right teachers, the right base, and he's doing great, you know. So I think sometimes that it is a matter of, stepping back and not being so ready to give the medication and do that and just realize that sometimes these boys are being boys. My sister's been an educator for over 40 years and doing elementary, and she's dumbfounded by the number of people who are quick to put the children on medication. So I just think that it would be really helpful to have that a lot clearer before the doctors are ready to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take my comments.
Thank you.
Here.
Thanks, Thank Judy. You. Dr. Graf.
So the implicit goals of medical practice are not to meet mistreatable conditions. And ADHD has a treatment, and we've been told that it has a treatment, and you can help people with it. So there's a lot of pressure. There's this direct-to-consumer advertising. There's lots of benefits potentially for prescribing a drug. But in my day-to-day practice, it's this constant balance between overlooking a treatable disorder and the chance to help someone, which is called benevolence, doing good,
mm-hmm.
the best interests of the child, versus the opposite, performing unnecessary tests, medicalizing behavior, in this case behavior, medicalizing other ailments, in other words, treating the human condition, and thus potentially causing some degree of harm. And it's finding this balance. I talk to our residents about this on rounds every day. In this case, the test of time is always the best test in life and in medicine. We use it the best. And I think in this case, the parent wanted to hold the line longer and appropriately, and things worked out well. And I think that's a very common story. I mentioned this before.
Well, it must be difficult, though, as a parent, if you are told by teachers, if you have a pediatrician or somebody in the medical community saying it may be helpful. How do you know, is it clear, when you should step back?
So I have met parents of first graders who came in and said, our son's not going to make it to second grade.
Ooh.
He's not going to be promoted. He's not doing well. They're talking about an individual education program, special education. And the parents are coming in because they're worried about outcome, performance, and the child's flourishing. And I'll notice the child has all of the traits of ADHD, and I'll say, okay, good. We could consider options, oftentimes a trial for a month, of a low dose of a medication combined with some other techniques, behavioral. And the parents come back and say, great, everything's fine now. No talk of an IEP. The child's going to be promoted to second grade. Everybody's happy. So in defense of real ADHD that can be treated, I think that's in the back of some of the doctors' minds. They don't want to misdiagnose or overtreat, but they certainly want to help kids have a good outcome.
Right. Let's go next. Thanks, Judy, for the call. Brad in Minneapolis. Hi, Brad.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am an adult. I'm in my late 30s, and I was only diagnosed with ADD inattentive disorder about 3 years ago, and it's frankly changed my life. And understand kind of, I guess, the takeaway from the drugs sometimes. And if I don't take my meds, my wife will ask, have you taken your meds today? And, you're talking about, just a few hours or whatever of testing. I went through an 8-hour battery, for this thing. And I said, it's been wonderful. I just wanted to make the comment.
Thank you, Dr. Graf.
Yeah, thanks for the comment. This is sort of the extension of the last caller, too, or the last comment to the last caller. My question for this caller is, how would your life have been different had you been diagnosed much earlier? And this is one of those questions in terms of looking forward versus looking backwards in time.
Do you have an answer for that, Brad?
Well, the answer is I don't rightly know. I'm smart enough and I guess bright enough that I was able to work my way through school. I hated studying. I hated, sitting down to do that. I didn't like it. I didn't like to study. I didn't want to do it. But I still, got through with A's and B's. And it really was affecting me more so in my job. I work in a job where I do different things from day to day, and that helped a lot. But having said that, I would have 6 projects going at the same time and couldn't finish any of them, whereas now I do.
Dr. Graf, we have about 30 seconds left.
And were you a coffee drinker?
No, but I went through 6 to 8 cans of Mountain Dew, give or take a day.
To
essentially self-medicate that way.
Yeah.
So that's about 300 milligrams of caffeine. That's not that much. So maybe you were underdosing. I don't know. But no, your stories are very interesting. You had six projects going on at the same time. That's multitasking. I don't know if you can do that so well. I don't know if anyone can do that so well. But there is an agreement now that adult ADHD is real, and it has a different set of symptoms, obviously, mm-hmm. than a first grader would.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Graf, thank you so much for being with us this hour. A lot of interest in the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Dr. William Groff, professor of pediatrics and neurology at Yale School of Medicine. We have the piece that was in the New York Times just a few days ago on ADHD. It's a very interesting article. It's on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for your interest and all of your calls. Tomorrow, there are 100 people out of 166 prisoners at Guantanamo who have been on a hunger strike for a long time. We'll talk about that during our 9 o'clock hour.